Welcome, everybody. Oli, you tell me, are we ready to go or
We are good to go. Thank
we're
you
good
so
to
much for
go?
joining us, and we're looking forward to this.
Okay, all right, fantastic. So, welcome, everybody. I hope everybody is in a better state than they were yesterday. I certainly feel much happier now that I've taken off the 3 weeks beard. Feel a lot better now. We are now putting the 3 weeks behind us and able to look forward. And the source sheets should be in the chat. I think Ollie is going to repost them right now so that everybody can pick them up. And we will, and today's topic that we're going to be dealing with is Rabbi Sacks's relationship that. To Medina Israel. And most of what I'm going to be doing today is coming from this book, Future Tense, which actually has just been translated into Hebrew. In Hebrew, it's called Belashon Atid. And it is literally just being translated, Future Tense. This came out in English in 2009. It came out for the 60th anniversary of the State of Israel or something like that. And this is Rabbi Sacks's look at Medina Israel. So let's begin by trying to frame this topic just a little bit. Let me start by saying that Rabbi Sacks was a phenomenal Zionist. In interviews after he passed away, his brother Alan spoke about the fact that he really would describe his brother, Rabbi Sacks, as a being a supreme Zionist. Rabbi Sacks, the minute he finished being chief rabbi, purchased an apartment in Jerusalem. I don't think he had much of a chance to spend a lot of time there because he was globetrotting and lecturing all around the world. But he loved being in Jerusalem. Before he became chief rabbi in England, he took off several months to live in Jerusalem and to prepare for his chief rabbinate by sitting and learning Torah, meditating and thinking in Jerusalem. And this was definitely something which was at the heart of his being. He really loved being in Israel, and we'll read a passage in just one moment. Second of all, he not only that, but he talks about his personal awakening. So many times we hear that his own personal awakening was to do with the Six-Day War. And to do with the events happening around Israel, which really jogged him to start taking his own independent Jewish journey. So there's no doubt that Israel was very much at the center of his being. And I think we could really say, sorry, if we could just.
Sorry,
And Israel was really at the center of that. Let's open the sheet. I'm going to share my screen.
still mute.
I want to start off with a pa Oh, you know, maybe even before I do that, I'll go in
Never
order.
work for me with technology.
Somebody who. Okay. The, you know, I'll start off with source number two on the sheet. I hope people can see it. And, then I'll go back to source number one. Just to show you how Rabbi Sacks really looked at Israel in such a positive way. This is in a book called Will We Have Jewish Grandchildren? And obviously that's what it's about. It's about the future of the Jewish people. And he says like this: Israel is now the only place in which total Jewish experience is possible. It is the one country where Jews constitute a majority of the population. It is the only context in which they exercise political sovereignty. It is the sole place where Judaism belongs to the public domain, where Hebrew is the language of everyday life, and where the Sabbath and festivals form the rhythm of the calendar. It is the land of our origins, the terrain in which Joshua and David fought, and Amos and Isaiah delivered their prophecies. It is the birthplace of Jewish memory and the home of Jewish destiny. It is impossible to overestimate the impact of Israel on the formation of Jewish identity. Jewish existence, which in today's diaspora may appear random, arbitrary, and disconnected, in Israel takes on coherence. There, the Bible comes alive against the background backdrop of its own landscape and its own language, once again a living tongue. There too, the concept of Jewish people becomes vivid in the visible drama of a society gathered together, as Moshe said it would be, from the ends of the heavens. Above all, it is in Jerusalem that the mystery of Israel becomes tangible. Here is the old new heart of the old new people, the place in which, said Maimonides, the divine presence never moved. Jews who spend time in Israel, whether they settle or not, are changed. In the modern diaspora, Judaism has been confined to the private domain of a home, school, and synagogue. Israel restores to Jewish life what it has lost elsewhere, a public dimension. Within its borders, Jewishness is out there in the street as well as in here in the soul. And that is why spending time in Israel is today essential to a full understanding of what it means to be a Jew anywhere in the world. So I think with that introduction, I think we would definitely say that Rabbi Sacks is somebody who you can hear just how enamored he is by the opportunities, our connection to the past, our connection to the present, our connection to our language, our connection to our people, and that Judaism isn't only in the private domain of home, school, and synagogue, but it has a public dimension. Interesting, he says, everybody should spend time in Israel. He doesn't say that everybody should move to Israel. Having said all of that, he was really, really, his big grandstand moment every single year, his Zionist moment, was the B'nai Akiva Yom Ha'atzma'ut service, where B'nai Akiva would hold a cross-communal Yom Ha'atzma'ut service every single year on the night of Yom Ha'atzma'ut. And for several years, Rabbi Sacks was the keynote speaker. I guess if you have Rabbi Sacks as chief rabbi, you can't not invite him. He, by the way, people who were there, I was already living, I've lived in Israel for 30 years, and I wasn't even in England when he became chief rabbi. But friends from B'nai Akiva told me that he was never as animated in his tefillah as on the night of Yom Ha'atzma'ut. He sung his heart out. And I just want to share with you a little bit of an address that he gave, which gives you a sense of really how he would talk on this occasion, which is really quite amazing. Just give me a minute to bring up the video. And yes, just one second. Hold on. Here we go. Just have to share my sound. Here we go. I hope people will be able to hear. Okay.
Jeremiah was not one of the mystics among the prophets. He wasn't particularly an optimist. If Jeremiah came back to Earth today, no doubt he would be an economist, one way or another. Here is a realistic man, not an optimist, who says there will one day be an exodus of the Jewish people and their return to the land that will be more miraculous even than the going out from Egypt. Now, how can that be? The going out of Egypt was accompanied by signs, wonders, 10 plagues, the division of the Red Sea, manna from heaven, water from a rock. What can be more remarkable than that? Except that it happened. And some of us were privileged to see it. Something happened during the first Gulf War in 1991. Saddam Hussein launched 39 Scud missile attacks on Israel. They were directed mainly on the coastal plain. Ben Gurion Airport was directly in their line of attack. All the flights to and from Ben Gurion Airport were cancelled for the whole of that time. For the duration of the war, the airport was like a ghost town. There was no one there, except for one flight that came in and left every single day, never stopped in the whole of that period. What was that flight? The flight bringing Olim Chadashim, new immigrants to Israel from former Soviet Union. That flight never faltered and never stopped. And with a shiver down my spine, I realized that we were seeing precisely what Jeremiah had foreseen. How come? Because the Torah says, "Vayhi b'shalach paro et ha'am v'lo nacham Elokim derek haaretz plishtim ki karovu." When Pharaoh let the people go, God didn't take them the quick route. Lest the people change their mind when they see war and they want to go over Shavu Mitzrayma, they want to go back. Even after all the signs, all the miracles, and all the wonders, God knew that if they saw war, they would turn back and go back to Egypt. And so the people responded. At the Red Sea, they said to Moses, was it that we were short of graves in Egypt that you took us out from Egypt? Why did we ever leave Egypt? At the episode of the spies, they said, let us appoint a head and go back to Egypt. And that after all the signs and the wonders. And there with our own eyes 21 years ago, we saw for the first time in all of history, a group of people, a massive group of people, eventually more than a million in number, following the first imperative of Jewry of all time, Lech Lecha, Me'atzecha, Mimoladetcha, Mi'beit Avicha, leaving behind their land, their home, their father's house, and coming to live in a country at war and under missile attack, an event unique in history. We lived to see the fulfillment of Jeremiah's vision, an exodus, not less miraculous, but more so than Yetziat Mitzrayim. The second miracle, Elaine and I witnessed a couple of years ago. A group of religious families forced to leave their home in Gush Katif as part of the Gaza withdrawal. Now, what did they do when they saw their homes, their farms, their shuls, everything they had built, forced to leave behind and eventually see destroyed? They could have sat and wept and never recovered. Instead, they found a place in the Midbar, in the desert, in the Negev, so hostile to habitation that no people had ever made their home there. They called it Chalutzit, and they said, here, we will build a home. And there, together with JNF, Elaine and I had the privilege of laying a foundation stone for the first school there. And I stood there. And for a second time, shivers went down my spine as I realized that we had been privileged to see the realization of a prophecy even older than that of Jeremiah, namely that of Isaiah, who said, as we say every Motzei Shabbat, Ki necham Hashem Tzion, God will one day comfort Zion, comfort all its ruins. How? V'yasemid barak ke'eden v'erva tagegan Hashem. He will make her desert like Eden, and her wasteland like the garden of the Lord. That is what the people of Chalutzit and others have done. And again, almost impossible to find a precedent for such behavior in the whole of history.
Okay, I'd love to share the whole video, and you can look up the whole video. I've given you the URL on the sheet. So you'll have to look at it all yourself and get the third area in which Zionism is even greater than Yetziat Mitzrayim. But I wanted to give you just a sense of the sheer energy of Rabbi Sacks on the night of Yom HaAtzmaut. And this is how he really believed in his Tzionut. And he was passionate about it. There's no doubt, though, and here I'm going to share a bit of another video. Maybe what she will just read it. Let's see, because we don't have a huge amount of time here. I'm going back to the sheet. And let's look at source number 3 over here and start listening to Rabbi Sacks's sort of critique, his first critique in a certain sense of Tzionut, or his let's call it his challenge, because, well, let's take a look. Source number 3, coming from the book Future Tense, he says this: the first challenge of Zionism, the creation of a Jewish state, has been brilliantly achieved. The second challenge, the creation of a Jewish society, has hardly been tackled at all. And let's see how else he talks here. Yet there is no single national narrative accompanying the modern state of Israel. Instead, there's been a succession of them. The earliest invoke series of scenes of heroic resistance, from Masada to the defense of Tel Chai, and Yosef Trumpeldor's last words, taken from Roman, not Jewish sources, "It is good to die for our country." Then came Ben-Gurion's narrative of a people whose history is recorded in the Bible, read not as sacred scripture, but as national literature. This told the story of a people that once made history as a nation in its land, then disappeared from history, living in suspended animation for 2,000 years before coming to life again in the 20th century. In the 1960s, after the Eichmann trial brought the Holocaust into Israeli discourse, came the story of Shoah Ugvura, destruction and rebirth. As Israel began the long process of Oslo, yet another voice began to be heard, that of post-Zionism, meaning an Israel without Jewish identity, a liberal democracy with procedures but no traditions. the one voice that might have supplied an enduring narrative, Judaism itself was more or less ruled out in principle because Judaism is a religion and Israel is a secular state. Now you start beginning to see how Rabbi Sacks wanted to see Israel and was a bit sorry that Israel had not become. In other words, Rabbi Sacks threw out a challenge in his book, Future Tense. He said that Israel has always had a culture of survival. It's had to fight all the wars. And of course, he's delighted and happy that Israel has won all the wars and he was the biggest supporter. And yet, what is he saying? Israel has had all these different ethoses, whether it's the Trumpeldor or the Masada from Mishoah Ligvura. But the question is, once we've survived, if Israel's just about survival, well, we've survived. But now what? Now what society are we going to become? And that's why he said Israel has passed its first test. It has learned to survive. But how's it going to learn to flourish and to become? Where's the Judaism? Now here, by the way, he once had the opening of when they launched the new, next time you come to Yerushalayim, please God, maybe it'll even be finished, the National Library. The National Library sits just next to the Knesset. The National Library is sort of between the Israel Museum and the Knesset. And in fact, they're building a beautiful new library. It's funded by the Rothschilds, I think. And it's actually got a roof, which is like, it slopes down so that you will still be able to see the Knesset building from the Israel Museum. It's a very clever architecture. And Rabbi Sacks was there at the opening together with none other than Amos Oz. And Rabbi Sacks was bemoaning the fact that Israeli youngsters can't even recite what are the Ten Commandments or don't even know what the books of the Chumash are. They don't even know the Chamisha Chumshei Torah. What did Amos Oz respond to him? Amos Oz responds to him and says, yes, but what they do know, they can speak in Hebrew. But the kids in England can't even speak Hebrew. It's a very interesting disconnect, right, between Rabbi Sacks heard him. And what was his response? He says, but why can't it be that we will speak in Hebrew and also know the Ten Commandments and also know the five books of the Torah? He was frustrated by the way that he couldn't communicate more in Ivrit. By the way, his communication in Ivrit wasn't a problem with language. It was more a problem that he couldn't draw on the same cultural breadth that he could in English, where he could draw on philosophy and poetry and Shakespeare. And he just felt he didn't have that command of the culture that he did in English. And therefore, he didn't even try. Generally, when he spoke in Israel, he spoke in English. I mean, his Hebrew is pretty good. I've seen discussions online which he held in Hebrew. His Ivrit, he could hold his own in Ivrit, but he wasn't nearly as eloquent. And that frustrated him. This is the challenge that Rabbi Sacks was throwing out. And I want to take this even back to the class that we had last week when we spoke about the book Morality. Remember, we spoke about the book Morality and the book The Politics of Hope. And if you recall, Rabbi Sacks says we can't just have the state. We can't just have the individual. We need families and communities. Now, I want to go into a theme which Rabbi Sacks loved talking about. And that was the notion of a covenant. You know what, let's try and we'll read a little bit from this. One of the areas where he saw this covenant coming together more than anything else was ironically in American inaugural addresses, the addresses of presidents in the United States of America. Let's take a look here and source number four. And hopefully this will all come together. It'll also come together, hopefully, with what we were discussing last week. On January 2nd, 20th of January 2009, a bright, crisp winter morning, Barack Obama was sworn in as the 45th president of the United States of America, the first African-American to hold office. It was a historic moment. It was a quintessentially 21st century speech, but at the same time, it followed the protocol, the language, the imagery, and key ideas of almost every other presidential inaugural address since Washington's first in 1789. What Barack Obama was doing was something that sets America's political culture apart from all others in the contemporary world. He was renewing the covenant. He was renewing the covenant, a form of politics born in the Hebrew Bible. Covenant has been part of America's self-definition since the beginning. It was present in the Mayflower Compact, where signatories agreed to covenant and combine ourselves into a civil body politic. It was the theme of John Winthrop's speech to 700 Puritans aboard the Arabella in 1630. And they talk about, thus stands the case between God and us. We enter into a covenant with him for his work. And the people must pledge themselves to follow the counsel of Micha, to do justly, to love mercy, to walk humbly with our God. And then we shall find the God of Israel is among us. These are the founding fathers of the United States of America. The biblical story of Exodus and redemption, freedom and responsibility, became the American narrative. Americans saw themselves as the new Israel and America the promised land. Like the Israelites in the days of Moses, they'd escaped from their own Egypt, England, from a tyrannical Pharaoh, George III. They'd crossed their Red Sea, the Atlantic, and like the Israelites, they were about to found a new kind of society, one that would serve as a moral example to the world. And by the way, that's why they called certain places Canaan and Jerusalem and what have you. Virtually every American president has explicitly or implicitly rehearsed this story at his inauguration. Jefferson did so in 1805. "I shall need to the favor of the being in whose hands we are, who led our fathers as Israel of old from the native land and planted them in a country flowing with all the necessaries and comforts of life." So did Lyndon Johnson in 1965. They came here, the exile and the stranger. They made a covenant with this land. And Bill Clinton said, "Guided by ancient vision of promised land, let us set our sights on a land of promise." Other countries use language of this kind, drawn as it is from the book of Exodus, Deuteronomy, and Prophets. Certainly not Israel, whose political culture is secular and drawn from other sources. The supreme irony of contemporary politics is that it's the United States of America who has a Judaic political culture. The state of Israel does not. I believe the time has come for this to change. Israel has ignored. Israel has ignored its own finest gift to politics, the concept of covenant, and all that goes with it, both before and after. Let's do the Jewish bit here. You know, even before we get there, let's stop sharing for a minute and let me explain. Rabbi Sacks, I think we explained in our first class that one of the things that Rabbi Sacks really believed was that Judaism had something amazing to give to the world. And in this regard, he looked to Jewish sources and said, actually, Judaism is a way of solving global problems. Let me just give you one example of this that he speaks. I heard him speak about many, many times. And this is what he said. And he, in fact, said that he discussed this with several British prime ministers and four different centuries of education, and they never, ever took it on. This is what he said. He said like this. He says, "What event does every Jewish child more or less know?" Rabbi Sacks dug into his own personal history. He says, "What do I remember when I was a child? We all remember the Seder. We remember the night of Pesach. You sit there with all the family, and you have all the beautiful fun of the family, but you also have maybe the annoying uncle and maybe the funny aunt and maybe the awkward cousins and whatever it works." The way that the Seder puts this is, you've got the Chacham and the Rasha and the Tam and the She'ena Yodei Lishol. You've got a very peculiar family. But what do we all do? We take a story and we don't let the story rest. We all tell the story. It's the same book every year, but we question it and we discuss it. And it becomes a sort of canvas whereby we can sort of tease out. On the one hand, we're all attached to this central narrative. But on the other hand, we're all going to sort of like pull it in our own individual directions, but we're still unified. Where did he apply this to, let's say, Britain in the 21st century? Well, he said the problem is like this. There was a time when there was a British way. There was the proper British thing to do. There was a proper British accent, and there were proper ways to act and all that stuff. But that's changed in multicultural Britain, where you've got so many different ethnic groups and all of that. So the question is, how is Britain going to become a single society? Rabbi Sacks says, you know what? We've got this thing called a Seder. Why don't you do it too? And in fact, what he suggested was, it was very interesting. He said that in England, they have a Remembrance Sunday. Remembrance Sunday, the Sunday closest to the 11th of November, commemorating the dead from the First World War. And he said, well, if the mourning, he sort of took it also a bit from Israel, where they have Yom HaZikaron and then Yom HaTzma'ut. He said, if in the morning we remember our past, why don't we spend our afternoon and maybe the next day, let's make a national holiday. And what we're going to encourage people to do through schools and through other things is to all get together, and we're going to write a covenant. We're going to write a speech, and the speech tells us who Britain are. And then every family will get together and have a meal or have a party, and there'll be TV shows and there'll be radio programs and all that. And they'll discuss this document. They'll discuss this sort of covenantal document, and it'll be a whole process with intellectuals and public figures and sports people and celebrities discussing this document. And this will become the document that everybody discusses. And slowly over time, this will become, there'll be a central narrative. And from there, we can build. Some people will take it in this direction. Other people will take it in this direction. But still, we have a central idea. And this, again, relates back to his thing that you have to create community. You have to do things through family. Now, he actually proposed this to the government of England and said, hey, we Jews have this thing. Why don't you take it? And that's really what he's saying about the United States of America, that they have this concept that they are bound by this covenant. Right, that they are bound by a covenant and that they've come to make a land with a sort of covenantal promise. And therefore, let's now go back. And he's basically saying that Medina Israel, I mean, by the way, some people in Israel today are saying exactly the same thing. They're saying that we need to spend more time on, for example, the Megillat HaTzma'ut, the Declaration of Israeli Independence, and literally do a commentary on that and have people learn it and all this sort of stuff. But now let's see how he goes back to our tradition. He says like this, both before and after the revelation, I'm at the bottom of page 2, the penultimate paragraph. Both before and after the revelation, when they hear the Ten Commandments, before the people all responded together, we will do everything the Lord has said. After they responded one voice, with everything that the Lord has said we will do. Before Naaseh and after Naaseh v'nishma, this was Israel's great foundational moment, its birth as a body politic, a nation under the sovereignty of God. What was transacted at Sinai was not a contract, it was a covenant. A contract is a transaction. A covenant is a relationship. A contract is about interests. A contract can be terminated by mutual consent when it no longer is in the interest of the parties to continue, but a covenant binds the parties even in, and especially in, difficult times. This is because a covenant is not about interest, but about loyalty, fidelity, holding together when everything else is driving you apart. That's why contracts benefit, but covenants transform. Covenants are not about power at all. They're mutually binding promise, a moral commitment. Social contract creates a state. Social covenant creates a society. Jews survived in exile for 2,000 years because they were a society before they were a state. They had laws before they had a land. They had a social covenant before they had a social contract. So even if the contract failed, the covenant remained. Even if they lost their state, they were still bound together as a covenanted nation. Now here, by the way, this is a tremendously important paragraph, and it's more than I have time to go into, but in the book, he goes into, for example, does the Torah believe in a king? We all know the Torah says, if you want, you can have a king, right? And there's a lot of ambivalence about a king. And he says, because the Torah is ambivalent about all different systems of power, but what's at the core is the notion that the Jewish people have made a covenant with God over the Torah. That is, our Torah is our portable homeland. That's the core of our identity. And we can have lots of different systems in place in order to lead us as a country, right? But at the core has to be this notion as a covenant, that there are certain values that we subscribe to. We will have certain systems, right? But that's the core of our identity. And now he throws out indeed this question. And this question is, well, if Israel is asking itself, what is it about? After Israel has got through the battle for survival, and again, if you compare the Israel today in the 2020s to the Israel of the 1950s and the Israel of the 1970s and even the Israel of the 1990s, it's so much stronger economically, militarily, fewer enemies, more peace, increasing. You know, if we had the peace with Egypt in the 80s and then the peace with the Jordan, which happened after Oslo, and now we've got the Abraham Accords and et cetera, we're in a different situation. He says, now's the time for Israel. And by the way, recently in Israel, there have been a slew of different books which are exactly asking themselves, recently a new book by Ari Shavit, asking this question, a book by Nathanael Ellenson asking this question, where are we going as a society? How are we going to make sure that the different tribes in Israeli society don't tear our society apart? This is the question that we're trying to grapple with in Israel. And Rabbi Sacks already 13 years ago was saying, hey, Israel, it's time to start asking the question about what's the glue that binds you. Once you've, you know, after you've dealt with the question of survival, what's next? What society do you want to become? And Rabbi Sacks felt that in some way the Jewish story had to really be at the center of this. This is what it, what we had to find. So this is where Rabbi Sacks, in a certain way, this is one of his critiques. So maybe I should say not a critique, but rather a challenge. Now, let me go. Let me go for a few other points which Rabbi Sacks talks about in his book on this topic, and let's. One thing that he takes a stab at, and you can totally understand it from what we've read about Rabbi Sacks already, is he talks about Ben-Gurion and Malachtiut. Let me just take help understand the notion of Malachtiut. There have been at least three or four academic books which are entitled Ben-Gurion and Malachtiut. Malachtiut means the power of a state, or as Rabbi Sacks will call it, statism. Let's see. We'll read in section 5. It was not accidental the most powerful effort to create a national culture, that of Israel's first prime minister, David Ben-Gurion, was called Mamlachtiut, statism, placing the state at the heart of identity. Ben-Gurion sought to create national cohesion. He saw that Israel had to move beyond what he called diaspora customs of disintegration, anarchy, lack of national responsibility and unity. Remember, I'm just taking a break from the text here. Ben-Gurion, you know, Israel's population tripled in the first decade of Israel. And suddenly you have not only kibbutznikim and not only Western Jews, but you've got Jews from the East, you've got Holocaust survivors, whatever it is. His biggest worry was the Judaism. He looked very negatively at the shtetl, where he saw whether it was in the shtetl or whether it was Odessa, the Jewish propensity to tear ourselves apart from within. What we've just been commemorating on Tisha B'Av, the Sinat Chinam, the tribalism. And he said, the only way we're going to do this is by having a very strong central government, institutions of state, and have everybody rally around those things. The army was part of this. The Kupat Cholim was part of this. Anybody who lived in Israel in the 50s and 60s knows exactly what I'm talking about. I'll keep reading on the fourth line here. His focus was on the institutions of the state itself, the Knesset, government-owned or funded bodies like the Histadrut, above all the Israel Defense Forces, For Ben-Gurion, Mamlachtiut was at the heart of the transformation necessary if Jews were to be able to exercise political sovereignty and power, having left it for 2,000 years. The emphasis of Mamlachtiut was the primary of the state over civil society, secular law over tradition and custom, governing institutions over voluntary bodies. This involved massive centralization and secularization. However, as Rabbi Sachs will say, Mamlachtiut rode roughshod over the traditions, mainly religious, of Jews from Arab lands who were forcibly socialized and secularized in immigration camps and state school system. Ben-Gurion said about these Oriental Sephardic Jews, they were from a Jewish point of view, dust of man, without language, without tradition, without roots, without an orientation to the life of statehood, without the custom as independent society. This left lasting resentments until this group organized itself politically in the form of the Shas Party in the mid-1980s. The result was that, though Israel managed remarkably the transition from powerlessness to power, it did so at the cost of weakening the very institution that had been the source of the Jewish strength in the past. Communities, charities, volunteers, associations, and community-based schools. Even religion became a branch of the state. And as I mentioned, Ari Shavit's new book is actually called Mishvatim La'am L'Shvatim, and the question is, can we still be an Am? So Rabbi Sachs was very troubled by this notion. Now remember what we learned in our last class. Rabbi Sachs says, the state shouldn't be everything, the individual shouldn't be everything. Where does he love seeing? Where does he see the core of identity, the core of power? Is he's a communitarian. He believes that it's families, religious groups, local associations, which are the core of where we learn the values. We can't learn our values from a state because it tends to flatline everybody. And it's an arena of competition, right? And Rabbi Sachs, obviously knowing that we all need a government, and obviously knowing that we're all individuals, right, still turns around and says that we need what Mamlachtiut was. It destroyed that middle level. What he's also trying to claim is that Israel's society has to, not just the government, but the whole society has to buy in to some sense of a real covenant. And that's where he, you know, that's one of his issues here with what's happening here. Now, I would like to say one thing. In this regard, I heard a wonderful lecture about Rabbi Sachs. And the person who was lecturing was an Israeli. And he said that here he really asked himself whether in this sense, when Rabbi Sachs is talking about Israel, and I'm still waiting to hear the reception to this book, because as I said, it's just been translated into Hebrew, that Rabbi Sachs was very, very suspicious of power. One of Rabbi Sachs's favorite themes when he spoke about himself as a chief rabbi and when he spoke about rabbis was he said that as chief rabbi, I have no power, I have influence. And because I have no power, I have more influence. The less power you have, the more influence you have. It's a very familiar theme, which, by the way, wasn't his own. Already before him, Rabbi Emanuel Jacobovitz, his predecessor, used to talk about this idea that as a man of religion, I have no power. Now, of course, in Israel, religion does have power, right? Religion, the Rabbanut has a tremendous amount of power in terms of marriage and divorce and personal status and kashrut and immigration and the law of return. So Rabbi Sachs shied away from anything which has to do with power. But as the person giving the lecture said, Israelis love power. Israelis are proud of their power. Israelis want to be Israeli through power. That's part of what Israelis are proud of. And in this regard, Rabbi Sachs, we have to ask ourselves how receptive Israelis would be to the message of Rabbi Sachs. And here's another area in which Rabbi Sachs is going to say something that I'm not quite sure that all Israelis, certainly not right-wing Israelis, would be receptive to. And this is another very interesting chapter, an earlier chapter in Rabbi Sachs's book. This is section 6, A People That Dwells Alone. Let's read a little bit. He's talking about a conversation he was having with a group of people, one of them an Israeli diplomat. And he says the conversation turned to the forthcoming UN conference against racism at Durban, later to become the notorious as the launchpad of a new and serious assault against the legitimacy of the state of Israel. It was then that the Israeli diplomat, a religious man, I wonder who it was, spoke, probably intending to dispel some of the gloom. And he said, "It was ever thus." And he quoted the famous lines of Bilam. And he said, "It is a people that dwells alone, not reckoned among the nations." And now Rabbi Sacks responded, and he says, "What makes you so sure that Bilam meant those words as a blessing?" I asked. "Might it not have been that he intended them as a curse? Consider," I said, "the incident of the word Badad, a people who dwell alone, in the Hebrew Bible. It is a verse about a leper. Badad yeshev michutz l'machaneh moshavo. It was used by Isaiah. The fortified city stands desolate. The fortified city stands desolate. An abandoned settlement falls forsaken like the desert. And most famously, it occurs in the first line of Eicha, right? Eicha yashva badad, ha'ira batiyam. God, who in monotheism is necessarily alone, the people of a people that dwells alone, is like Max Weber's description of the Jews as a pariah people. Consider," I continued, "who said the words, 'It is a people that dwells alone,' is the pagan prophet Bilam, who according to the Pentateuch was an enemy of the Israelites. The Talmud says, 'Better the curses of which Achiah the Shilonite cursed Israel than the blessings which with Bilam blessed them.' The sages believe that though Bilam had blessed the people, he'd done so in a deliberately ambiguous terms, so the blessing would become a curse. I realized I delivered an outburst, but I felt driven to continue. 'There is a psychological phenomenon,' I said, 'of a self-fulfilling prophecy. That," I concluded, "was the perennial Jewish danger. If you define yourself as the people that dwells alone, that will be your fate. You will convince yourself that you have no friends. You are isolated. No one understands you. The world hates you. Your efforts at self-explanation will be half-hearted. Your expectation of winning allies will be low. You will not invest as much effort as others do to make your case in the audience chamber of the world," etc. And next paragraph: "Jews have enemies, but we also have friends. And if we worked harder, we would have more. The inward-looking strategy made sense for 2,000 years when Jews were dispersed across the globe, everywhere a minority, without rights and without a voice in the public domain. It makes no sense now in the diverse, multi-faith and multicultural liberal democracies of the West. For perhaps the first time in history, the Jewish voice is respected. It is turned to for wisdom. If Jews fail to make their voice heard, there will not be silence. The space will be filled by other voices, not always sympathetic to Jews and Judaisms. Jews were called on to be a blessing to the world. They cannot do that if they're disengaged from the world. The place where that engagement is most important, Israel, the land where Judaism was born." This is quite a chapter, and I read it, and I've got to say, it really gave me food for thought. Because frequently, and we've just experienced, not 6 weeks ago, what was it, 6 weeks ago, all of that, the violence in Gaza, the rockets, a huge outburst of anti-Semitism worldwide, sometimes by government figures, certainly on the web, on social media. And it's true that many, many governments stood by Israel. And yet, I think all felt that something ferocious was going on. Rabbi Sacks is saying, let's not look at ourselves as always an object of anti-Semitism, an object of hatred. We can win friends, and we have to stand up there confident to try to do that. I know that's something that Yair Lapid is trying to do at the moment. He believes he can. Bibi was far more suspicious of the world, far more negative. Maybe it's a more right-wing, left-wing argument. But this was once again something that Rabbi Sacks says, that he wants Israel to be an Or LaGoyim. He doesn't want Israel to see itself as a pariah state. He wants Israel to engage in the world. He wants Israel to become more Israeli. He's suspicious of Mamlachtiyut. He wants to see Israel digging into itself into its Judaism, in order to build itself from the inside and create a culture which will be able to take it forward for the next 60 years and longer. That is what he's talking about. I'm just going to take, I see there's a lot of activity in the chat. So Somebody's asking, what did Rabbi Sacks post to make the more than 20% of the population who are not Jewish feel they're included in the social covenant? Right, that's a very interesting question, but I would ask the, I would suggest that sometimes there are, for example, I would say that in America, there are certainly a lot of Jews who feel part of the American narrative. And you would obviously have to make the Jewish values, obviously there'd be a more, how should I say it, narrow, particularistic way of looking at them. But then you would also have a way where, as you say, the 20% of the population who are not Jewish would have to be able to somehow tap in to some sense of Jewish, the Jewish narrative. And even our Haftarah, which we read on the fast day, talks about the B'nai HaNechar, people who aren't Jewish, having a part in the Brit, in the covenant of God. In other words, even in the visions of Isaiah, there is an understanding that not everybody is Jewish, but that somehow everybody can be part of a covenant of God. So I think that's sort of possibly what Rabbi Sacks would have turned around and said when he is talking about this. There's much more in this book. And this book also talks about, he's got a whole section about Torah and Chochmah and many other chapters. But what I'm going to do for the last few minutes of the class is just relate to a couple of other themes, since I said we would talk about Rabbi Sacks and the State of Israel. I will relate to a few other passages where Rabbi Sacks dealt with Israel. And first we'll start off with Torah, and then we'll move to politics afterwards. One of the lovely themes that Rabbi Sacks speaks about throughout his books is that Am Yisrael is meant to be an alternative to the great cultures. It was true in the ancient world that Israel is between Egypt and Mesopotamia and was meant to represent an alternative. And he also looked at Jewish culture as providing a alternative to the values of certainly of totalitarianism on the one side, but also even of the West, of Western materialism, commercialism, individualism on the other side. He has this lovely section in his book where he talks about why Eretz Yisrael. And this is going to be Parshat Shavua, Parshat Shavua, not this week, but next week. So it'll be great for us to take a look at it. And he says, why the land of Israel? And he calls it the land that makes you look to heaven. Again, I just want to, he says, there's another intriguing footnote within the Bible itself as to why this land is different. In a master stroke of delayed information, Moshe tells Am Yisrael, they are almost within sight of the land, that there is a qualification to the description he gave them previously, that is a land flowing with milk and honey. It's a good land, but with one caveat. And he says, and now he quotes from Devarim, the land you are entering to take over is not like the land of Egypt from which you came, where you planted your seed and irrigated it by foot as a vegetable garden. The land you're crossing the Jordan to possess is a land of mountains and valleys that drinks rain from heaven. It is a land that the Lord your God cares for. The eyes of your Lord have got to continue on it from the beginning of the year to its end. And now he says, Israel is not the Nile Delta or the Tigris-Euphrates Valley. It is a land dependent on rain. And rain in that part of the world is not predictable. We knew this already. Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov all have to leave the land temporarily because of drought and famine. But the passage intimates a correlation between geography and spirituality. Israel is a place where people look to heaven in search of rain, not down to earth and its natural water. It is a place where you have to pray, not one in which nature and its seasons are predictable. And this is part of a larger narrative. Because the terrain of Israel is such that it cannot become the base of an empire, it will constantly be a threat from larger and stronger neighboring powers. Israel will always find itself outnumbered. It will need to rely on exceptional courage from its soldiers and ingenuity in battle. That will take a high national morale, which in turn will require the people a sense of belonging to a just and inclusive society. Commitment will be needed from every individual. They will need to feel their cause is justified and they're finding something worth preserving. So the entire configuration of the Torah's social ethics, whose guardians were the prophets, is already implicit in a kind of geopolitical entity that Israel is and will be. It will always be small and highly vulnerable country set in a strategic location at the location of three continents, Europe, Africa and Asia. And what do we need to do? Turn to one another and turn to God. Okay, once again, what are you hearing? You're hearing religion at the core, God at the core, and, should I say it, a certain aversion to power, a certain aversion to power. Okay, we've got 10 more minutes, so let me deal with two last topics, and then maybe we'll have some time for questions. One is a political question. Well, I guess they're both in a way political. One is a question of the Palestinians. And here, Rabbi Sacks got in hot water for saying this, but I think he believed it. And he writes in this book, I believe that the Palestinians should have a state. Now, he wrote this again. He wrote this in 2009. Maybe things will have changed by now. But he did write it after Oslo and after Gush Katif. So he said, I believe the Palestinians should have a state. So do the overwhelming majority of Israelis. I believe they should have freedom and dignity, and their children should have a future. That there should be an end to the terrible suffering that existed since 29th September 2000 because of the collapse of the peace process. Their fate has been a tragic one, and no one with the slightest humanitarian instinct could wish it to continue. Jews did not return home to deny others a home. This was neither the intent of the early settlers, the Chalutzim, nor the language of the Balfour Declaration or the United Nations Resolution. The tragedy is that Israelis can understand the plight of the Palestinians better than any other people on earth. They know what it is to eat the bread of affliction and bitter herbs of suffering. It's quite evocative language. They know that Jews are commanded to love the stranger. The broad shape of the solution to the problem of Israel and the Palestinians has never been in doubt. It was implicit in the Balfour Declaration in 1917, explicit in the 1947 United Nations Resolution on Partition, two states for two peoples, a political solution to a political problem. As Shimon Peres said when someone asked him whether he could see the light at the end of the tunnel, he said, I can see the light. The problem is there is no tunnel. The solution is clear. The question has always been how to get from here to there. Now, by the way, in the book, I just don't want you to think that he is a misty-eyed leftist, even though I wouldn't say that's necessarily an insult, but it's not always good to be misty-eyed. But I will say that he says very, very clearly that he feels that the Palestinians have missed every opportunity to forward their society. He is very strident about the faults of the Palestinians, but in the broad taxonomy of where he would like things to go, I think if we're talking about Medina Israel, that's something very important to mention. The other thing which places Rabbi Sacks, and by the way, in this regard, Rabbi Sacks once again is following the tradition of British chief rabbis. I still never forget, as a university student, I once walked out of the London School of Economics where I went to university, and I saw the billboards on the streets of the Evening Standard. And I still remember they said in big black letters, Chief Rabbi shames Israel. And this was during during one of the campaigns, I think, in Lebanon. And Rabbi Jacobitz, of course, the press had blown up what he said, but he had said that what had happened, I don't know, either his heart bleeds or that he was upset about what Israel had done or Israel had stepped over the line. And headlines, of course, Chief Rabbi, I remember walking out, I was actually walking out with some fellow Muslim classmates, and suddenly you see Chief a Rabbi shames Israel. This wasn't Rabbi Sacks, this was Rabbi Jacobowitz. But it's interesting that the chief rabbis of Britain, certainly Jacobowitz and Sacks, had a relatively liberal views when it came to these issues. And this takes me to the last point, which you'll see on the last page of your sheet, which is the question of messianism. And maybe with that we will finish. You know, there is this tradition that the Mashiach will be born on Tisha B'Av, right? That somehow out of Tisha B'Av, right, we wait for Mashiach, we wait for the Geula. And of course the question is, will we, like we said yesterday in Nachem, where we say that God destroyed the temple in fire, and with fire he will bring it down from heaven? I once heard Rav Yoel ben Nun, a famous Tanakh scholar, say that he cannot say that line, because to say that the temple will come down fire from heaven means that it will be a sudden jolt process. And he said that has never been the case. Just like we slowly became a people in the first temple and we slowly built the second temple, He believes that we will slowly and gradually build the third temple, and that's what we're seeing with Medina Israel. And therefore, he's not waiting for a temple coming from heaven. We have to build the temple. That was Rav Yoel ben Nun. Here, if you look on our sheet, Rabbi Sacks relates to six different theories of how to relate to the question of Mashiach. I'm looking on page 6 and page 7 on the question of Reshit Tzmichat Gulatenu. What is the relationship? This is the transcript of a lecture. What is the relationship of the current state of Israel to the Messianic age? And he talks about 6 different views. Rav Kook, that it is indeed Reshit Tzmichat Gulatenu, the Atchalta de Geula, where the assumption of Rav Kook is that it's a one-way street, and that the significance of Medina Israel is that Medina Israel will lead to the Geula. Rav Reinus, Pikuach Nefesh, it is a way of saving Jews. Nature Karta, it's not messianic, it's anti-messianic, it's demonic, right? It's taking us away from Mashiach. Secular Zionists, interesting, he says, they thought that Theodor Herzl was Mashiach, right? That it would be a socialist utopia, a communist utopia, a cultural utopia, whatever utopia you can think. In other words, secular Zionists simply took the Mashiach idea and said Medina Israel is the embodiment or will become the embodiment of a secular Zionist dream. Then he quotes Brennan Berdyshevsky, who said, we don't believe in Mashiach. We just want to be, we want normality. And then he says, finally, the extremely boring, but nevertheless not bad view of the chief rabbis of Great Britain, the late Sir Israel Brody, the late Lord Jacobowitz, and myself, all who have mandated forms of the prayer for the state of Israel, which do not contain the phrase Reshit Tzmichat Tenu, which the Israel is religiously significant, but which we are not yet ready to say that it is of messianic significance. And he says, well, here, you've just got to get Rabbi Sacks' humor. He says, these are the 6 views, and of course, there are many more, like the friend of mine in Jerusalem who calls his plumber Mashiach. He says, I await him daily. He never shows up. That's a great line. But he says, and here we'll finish with this, maybe good for the day after Yom Kippur. He says, the classic Jewish answer is, has Mashiach come? The answer is not yet. However, in the very not yet are 2 monumental assertions, and this is what I want to say. Number 1, when we say not yet, we're saying no to any premature conciliation, any willingness to settle for less than our vision of an ideal world. How can we say with Christianity that the Messiah has come in a world still riven by violence, conflict, terrorism, inequality, and injustice? How could we say with other great Jewish messianic vision, Marxist communism, that the world is saved by the mere withering of the state? I mean, for heaven's sake, one is okay, one's a nightmare. But we've been prepared always to say not yet. We will not settle for premature consolations. The other thing that we say not yet, but we will still say, Im kol ze achakelo b'chol yom sheyavo, afal pikein, we still await him every day, is the refusal to accept the second alternative, which is that the world we inhabit today is the world of postmodernism in which there are no ultimate meanings. Rabbi Sacks says, we insist that there is a Mashiach. In other words, there is a meaning. There is a purpose of this world. On the other hand, Mashiach has not come yet. We're not prepared to accept halfway stations. As he says in the first one, we say the meanings of our world are not private. They're shared. They're something we call the common good. And that means we absolutely reject both those who think that salvation has come. We absolutely reject both those who think that salvation has come or within reach and those who say there is no such thing. So that also relates to Medina Israel, where as a religious Zionist, Rabbi Sacks saw the significance of Zionism as a place where Judaism could be lived to the maximum. He saw and was inspired by Medina Israel as the fulfillment of prophecies, as you heard in that sicha at the beginning, where he was giving a lecture, a sermon about how Medina Israel is even, in the words of Yeshayahu, even greater, in the words of Yirmiyahu, even greater than Yitziat Mitzrayim, and at the same time refused to give it verifiable messianic significance. And he had constantly treading this very interesting line. Again, it might be the luxury of somebody who lives in Chutz La'aretz and has the possibility to look on the outside, not a player on the inside. Hilary Silver is asking the question, what did he think of the rabbinate notion? He was very, very against it. He really wanted to see the rabbinate, the religion, as something that people could choose and not something that was coerced. He wanted to see it that people would decide to be religious or not on their own private decision and not something which the state got involved with. And that's, again, his notion of not power, but influence. So I'm going to take another look at the chat. I can see things I didn't expect that this would not arouse a certain amount of... Sol, I agree with you. It depends on the definition of Mashiach. I totally hear you. But at some level, Mashiach is some sense of geula, redemption. And therefore, you know, you have to go with that. What Professor Lawrence Kaplan says, that the view of chief rabbis is that of Rav Soloveitchik, is 100% true. Arthur Stein says, did he ever comment explicitly about Gaza after the withdrawal and after the takeover of Hamas? Yes, what I read to you was this line about the Palestinians is in this book, Future Tense, which was published in 2009. So that's after the withdrawal. I can't remember which year Hamas took over. But that speech which he gave, if I'm not mistaken, which you saw at the beginning, that speech to B'nai Akiva, where he talks about dedicating the school of Yishuv, of people who are the Megurashei Gush Katif. So obviously he met the people who had left Gush Katif. He was inspired by the people of Gush Katif. But I think still at the same space, I think he still felt what he felt about the Palestinians. Again, I don't know whether practically, I like that line, even which Shimon Peres said, which is, I see the line at the end of the tunnel, but I can't see a tunnel, right? Which is a great line, because Rabbi Sacks wasn't a politician, and therefore he wasn't claiming that he had the way to the solution. He was saying, I know where I'd like it to lead. I have no clue how to get there. That's not my business. Now, again, you could say that's not fair to do that, but I mean, he was admitting that. He was saying that himself. Okay, I don't want to keep people. He seems like he was serious and also a funny guy. Rabbi Sacks did love humor. Rabbi Sacks really believed that humor was very important. In his book, Celebrating Life, I think one of his first articles is how he really talks about how he believes in humor. He frequently used to start off his lectures with a good joke. And he really felt that humor was something that God had put in the world in order to help people smile and be happy. And yes, he did appreciate some good humor, even though he was, a towering intellectual. But Ezrat Hashem, next time, we are going to be studying Rabbi Sacks' book, or segments of Rabbi Sacks' book, The Great Partnership. The Great Partnership was a book published, I think, in 2015. And it's a book about religion and science. And what we're going to talk about when we talk about is how do we square Bereshit, the creation story, with evolution. Rabbi Sacks tried to deal with this in a huge amount of detail and put a whole source book in the back of his book there. And we're going to try and cover the way that Rabbi Sacks, sort of his vantage point. In this regard, by the way, Rabbi Sacks was very courageous. He took on some of the leading evolutionary biologists, and that's what we're going to be discussing in public debate. And that's what we're going to be discussing next time. That's going to be lecture number 6. And lecture number 7, we're going to actually talk about his more, so to speak, Jewish writings. We're going to go into the Siddur. We're going to go into some of his Parashat Shavua. And that's Be'ezrat Hashem what we'll do in our final lecture. Go back to the Torah. So thank you very much, everybody. And thank you for all the thanks that I'm seeing in the chat. And wish everybody a really good week. And stay safe, stay well. And I look forward to seeing you same place, same time next week.
Thank you so much, Rev. Alex. It was a lovely, lovely, like very insightful lecture. If anybody is interested in the rest of the programs that are happening this week, I will put the link in the chat. There's a lot going on this week. There's a lot of people to learn from, a lot of good things to learn. So if anybody is interesting, I'm putting a link to the programs section on the website in the chat.